What a great crowd we have here tonight. Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Arzu Mohseni and it's a great pleasure introducing tonight's program with Darius D. Himes and Mary Virginia Swenson. We're here to celebrate the upcoming release of Publish Your Photography book with a discussion and Q&A session. This is the first book to exclusively demystify the process of producing and publishing photography books. Our guests provide an overview of the book industry as they present a survey of the current landscape of photography book publishing and point out the many avenues to pursue and pitfalls to avoid. A founding editor of PhotoEye Booklist, Darius D. Himes co-founded Radius Books, a nonprofit company publishing books on visual arts. He's also a lecturer, consultant, and writer who has contributed to numerous publications. Mary Virginia Swenson is a consultant in the area of licensing and marketing fine art photography. She frequently lectures and conducts workshops for photographers and students. She's widely recognized for her blog, Marketing Photos, and as a respected judge of awards and competitions. I'd like to thank both of them for appearing in tonight's event, which is an artist career development program addressing the growing needs and concerns of the creative workforce in New York City. I would also like to encourage everyone in this room to visit the art and picture collections at Mid-Manhattan Library across Fifth Avenue from here, where you can freely browse one of the most accessible and comprehensive circulating collection of 40,000 books and videos covering every aspect of art, architecture, and design, and over 1 million pictures covering 12,000 subjects. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to Darius and Mary Virginia.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. It's great.
Can you all hear us with these microphones?
And me as well? That's great. Thank you so much for coming out in the rain. And I'm so happy you're all here and not outside in the overflow crowd.
Yeah, and thank you so much. It's nice to speak to a room full of people. And it's also nice to be here at the New York Public Library, which
thank
obviously
you.
Is a historic institution, and it's quite an honor. So thank you. So Mary Virginia and I have this new book coming out, Publish Your Photography book. And we thought we would start just talking for a minute about how this book came about. So back in 2003, I was the editor of a small quarterly magazine called the PhotoEye Booklist, which was a magazine that was devoted exclusively to photography books. And at a Society for Photographic Education conference one year, I approached Mary Virginia about doing a column that was devoted to photography books and somehow outlining just the ins and outs of the process. Both of us had talked about the fact that every time we talked with photographers, the question was always, how do I get a book of my photographs published? And so the journal seemed like the perfect venue for that. So
we mapped out a schedule, and as we got into the thinking about it, we realized, well, that topic could take 2 issues, and that one, if we do that, we're going to need 3 for that. And it grew and grew. And we ended up doing 12 issues. It ran till 2007. And the main reason that we felt like now was the time for our book was 2 particular areas that had changed substantially in our eyes. The first of which was the capabilities now of print on demand, which I'm sure many of you have tested, if not you're all aware of, being able to make one book of your work. And for me, and for Darius, it's really about knowing your work better, the beauty of print on demand. The second thing that we feel has changed quite a bit since our column was the collectible fine art book, the limited edition, and all the attention now, the importance of a book in your career. And it just made us sit back and go, okay, I think now really is the time. And we've covered all of that in our publication that we're going to share with you tonight.
Yeah, so as many of you know, the last 10, 15, 20 years in the photography book publishing world has really seen several things. It's seen the landscape shift for many of the major publishers, but then it's also seen this an explosion in photography book publishing that happens to fly under the radar of most of our popular media. So there's lots of activity happening. And so the magazine was the first venue for this, but as Swanee said, we've sort of we've adapted that, talked about print on demand, and really wanted to write a book, as the column was, but more so in the book, write a book that was written specifically for photographers. So you're our audience, and we're going to try to cover a lot of territory. We're going to try to talk about an entire industry and various satellite components to that industry all in like an hour.
Yeah, no problem.
Which is
right?
Pretty much impossible.
And save some time for Q&A.
Exactly.
Let's see if this...
So this is when we first put together this slideshow, I had written on the upper left corner, I said my title for this was The Protagonist, which is this idea that here's the blank book. This is the tabula rasa of everybody's project in their own hearts and minds. And assuming that you're all photographers in this room, the phrase that's on your mind is this: I want a book of my photographs. Exactly. So we're going to try to talk about that. And one of the things that we do in the book, and we'll also do a little bit tonight, is ask you all to put on your thinking caps for a minute and step back from wondering how the whole publishing process works to really break this statement down into three very basic component parts, the first of which is the person making the statement. Every single person in here, as a photographer, has a different project, is at a different point in their career, may have just started school and a photography program and is wondering about the publishing process, may have just come out of a program, may have been working locally and is looking to expand the range of their products and their assignments sort of regionally or nationally.
You might have an exhibition coming up in a couple of years on the calendar of a major museum and you want to have a book for that.
Getting a sense of who you are, really, really being serious in your assessment about your own sort of where you are in your own career as a photographer. One of the themes of this evening will be that we try to make clear that there's no formula for this. There's no way to say here's how you make a book or here's how you find exactly the right publisher. Just as every person in here is individual, publishers are individuals and have their own aesthetic differences. And there are lots of different types of photography books. So this idea of where you are in your career and being frank in your assessment and being clear about what it is that you want to achieve with this book is important. So that's something that that you can spend some time writing and thinking about. The next element of this very basic phrase is the book itself. So I want you all to sort of close your eyes for just a second, and when I say the word book, what is it that you have in mind? So there's so many different types. For some of you, if you want to open your eyes now, maybe this is the book. For some of you, it might be this. So just this idea, just joking aside, there's all sorts of different types of photography books. Some of you may have very classic things in mind. When you say, I want a book of my photographs, you're imagining yourself as this, you know, adventurer photographer who's making these grand landscapes in the American West, and you have a certain type of book in mind. Being aware of and thinking about the range of titles that are published and really just spending time looking at books is important. This is a classic photography book. That might be the one that's in your mind. This is also a contemporary classic photography book that looks nothing like the previous book. That may be the one that's in your mind. This is Alex Soth's Sleeping by the Mississippi. Another classic contemporary photography book that has no indication that it's a photography book on the cover. So again, looking through and thinking about this, this happens to be one of the 10 volumes that makes up Paul Graham's A Shimmer of Possibility. Another recent book, Alex Webb and Rebecca Norris Webb's Violet Isle. So this idea of just spending time, whether it's in your own library at home or whether it's at a local bookstore, and just looking at and thinking about the range of projects, the range of presentations, the different type of cover treatments, all of those things, thinking about that element of that statement when you say, I want a book of my photographs, What do you have? What do you envision? Just to become aware. This part is really about self-reflection and being aware of what the assumptions or the thoughts that you have in your mind are. The last statement, which is up to you, the last part of this statement is, I want a book of my photographs. The photographs are your job. And so we're not going to cover that tonight. But that's the way, in the book we do talk about that whole, you know, just taking this very basic statement and really trying to break it down and understand what it means for each of us. So, do you want to jump?
Sure. I think one of the most important things for me is you thinking about why publish at that time, and what role does the book play in your career at that point. It may be that you have a story to tell, and one of our favorite examples is David Maisel's Library of Dust, which I hope all of you are familiar with this project, but a very distinct, very specific body of work about life and death and
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't want to go too deep into.
Yeah, no, exactly. But this part of the presentation and just part of the book is this idea of, all right, you've sort of assessed where you are in your career, you have a project, but now really trying to get at what is it that this book is doing for you in your career, and it may be that there's a story to tell, and so this idea, many of us have come to the photographic tradition through some of the great storytelling photographers and magazines and venues, and so thinking that through. And there's a couple more examples of just some of the great photographic stories that have been told in recent years. This is Norman Mauskopf's A Time Not Here. Two recent books that have been published this decade, Geet Van Kesteren's Why, Mr. Why? And Baghdad Calling, both of which, he's a Dutch photographer that was working in the arena of war in Iraq and couldn't find a magazine to publish his work simply because so much of the great documentary magazines have either folded or have stopped showing work. And so he spent time essentially cobbling together a group of European organizations that would support a book project. So again, this idea of really wanting to tell a story and finding a way to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And then this is a great spread from Gil Perez's book, The Silence, one of the Magnum photographers that's based out of France.
And I know for many of you that having a book is not too dissimilar from what happens when you have an exhibition. It helps you to kind of bring that body of work to closure and move on in many cases. So another thing is that you may have something that you've just got to say that's completely yours, and the only way that you want to get it out there is in a book.
And this may not be a narratives type story. The way we're thinking about this is, it's this idea that, okay, there's a great documentary tradition, a journalistic tradition. There are other traditions within photography. The working photographer as artist who is not working for magazines is not necessarily telling a story so much as producing work that stands as its own kind of discrete body of work. A great book that existed, this is a legendary book by a New York photographer, Roy De Carava, who photographed in the jazz clubs during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And this book existed simply as an artist book for decades before he was able to find a publisher, and it eventually came out. So this idea of, again, wanting to say something and waiting and working to find the right time and the right publisher.
John Gossage, The Pond.
Exactly. This is another book that came out, was the first book in John's career. Mm-hmm. Rather obscure work, but and at times impenetrable, but it was something that he felt very strong about.
And Aperture has recently republished this work. This is one of the 7 case studies in our book, where we go in depth with John about that process. Adam Foos,
another New York-based photographer who's a working artist and one of his titles. So these are the last 3 books are really not mainstream in any way, but they were important. They're important books in the careers of these photographers. Mm-hmm.
And again, it may be that you want to move your career to the next level, and we've seen that happen again and again for artists when their dealer has something to share with potential clients, when museums can have something to sell in conjunction with an exhibition. For many people, it does make a difference in their career. Sean Perry is one of the artists that's here tonight. For Sean, he wanted to produce a volume for his first solo exhibition that was slightly different and that would be a different price point than the prints themselves, but again be something rare and beautiful. so produced a limited edition book, another of our case studies in our book, of tipped-in prints in a rather traditional way, not unlike what we grew up with, camera work and such, seeing those kinds of objects.
And then Stephen Gill is a photographer in his, I believe he's in his late 30s, and he's self-published, this was his first book that he self-published called Hackney Wick, that is also now a sort of classic of the last 10 years in photo book publishing, but it was something that he self-financed and he was able to sort of distribute himself. But it was something that really launched his career as a photographer and a bookmaker. So again, thinking through these reasons to publish, there are nuances beyond something like, for instance, I need to have a career or I need to make money. This idea of like, okay, taking that as a given. What are the very specific things about wanting to publish? Whether it's having a story, telling a narrative, getting a story out, developing your career, putting out a body of work as an artist. These are all different specific things.
And you'll set those priorities for yourselves. Then it's a matter of sitting down and refining your concept. So one of the things we call the big idea.
The big idea. So also, in talking with a lot of photographers, one of the stumbling blocks at the early stages of developing a book project is really grappling with what is this book about? Just even that very basic statement. So many photographers will be master craftspeople. They've spent time working on projects. They've gone out. They have a whole... maybe one or two decades worth of work that's sitting at home and they're trying to figure out what to do with it. And that idea of, I want to get this work out into the world, maybe the book is the right way. So, okay, taking that sort of as a starting point, but then really, what is this particular book about? And I'll just say sort of straight off the bat, career surveys of artists in terms of a book really do not sell. If you're Lee Friedlander, then that might sell. But
or perhaps if there's a traveling exhibition or if that's going to support that for 2, 3, 4 years, that always helps.
Exactly. Marketing. But career surveys of photographers that nobody has heard of do not sell. So then it becomes a question of, okay, how do I take this mountain of work that I have at home and start carving out specific projects or specific bodies of work that do make sense as a book? Maybe you find that you spent time going back home every summer, whether that home was in wherever, Arkansas or Los Angeles, and you've got 20 years of work all from that place. That may be a body of work that could be actually carved into a book out of the sort of larger body of work that you've made. Thinking things through that way.
That may also be the kind of thing that has an audience that's definable. If it's about Los Angeles, then you can find an audience for that work. Whether your name is known yet or not.
Exactly. Or you may have a subject that is so widely popular that all it requires is one word as the cover. Birds. So this is actually a fun example. Andrew Zuckerman is a photographer. I think I'm not sure where he's based. But he worked mostly in the studio, took a concept that is extremely popular on a broad area. And this is, as you can see, even by the title treatment and then the author name treatment in the text, what's the main subject of this book? Is it the photographer?
No,
it's birds. Andrew Zuckerman is like 1/10 the size of the word bird. So in that, and he's made a name for himself as a photographer, but the point is, the publisher is making sure that you know that this is a book about birds. It's not a book about the photographic career of Andrew Zuckerman, as fantastic as that may be. It's for the person who knows nothing about Andrew Zuckerman but loves birds. And there's a lot of people that love birds. You can, if you go home and Google annual sales for bird-related objects, it's like billions of dollars. So you've got a guaranteed audience if you've got a project about birds.
It's like right up there in the horses and dogs and cats,
horses,
right?
Dogs, birds, big celebrities. Sellers. Those are all you're going to... Those are all good subjects.
Can I go to Creature?
Yes.
Here's another one.
So his previous book was called Creature. Obviously, sort of the same typographic treatment. If you bought Creature and loved that, you're going to be interested in birds. So again, this idea of thinking about a project in relation to an audience. And this become this sort of this will start to tie into a point here, mm-hmm. just in the just coming up.
And so it's so widely popular that there can be what we call ancillary products or paper products that spin off of it. And even Michael Kenna has calendars and note cards and things. So I think Andrew Zuckerman's found a great niche with the Bird Book and Creature and some of the others, but they're really pleasing, very easy to absorb and live with, and so it's been fantastic for him to take that work into multiple formats.
One of the things I think that I think is exciting about what's happened over the last maybe 10, 20 years is that the visual vocabulary of the average citizen has increased. We see images all the time. We look at books with photographs. We're inundated with visual language as much as we are with written or verbal language. So the sophistication of the average person has raised. So being aware of the visual language that you're employing in your photographs may also give you a key to what sort of audience you can go for. This is work. There's nothing objectionable about either the subject matter or the presentation. It's very digestible. It's this high-key sort of photographs shot in a studio. It isolates the bird. It's very easy to digest. And the book has sold, you know, while it's wildly popular. So thinking also about your own work in relation to the language that you employ is important.
Another example from the Bird Book. Then we talk a bit about who's your audience. And as I was using the Los Angeles example, if you have a sense of who you want to talk to with your work, i.e. your audience, and can identify them, where they are, and how many they are, you have so much more information that you can then take to a publisher and have them better understand where this might fit in their catalog.
Exactly.
So we think about things in a couple of different ways, but basically small, medium, large, and extra large, both on the size of your audience and on the size of your project.
This is just a very easy way to kind of think about not only the type, what, you know, your own work, you've got the work that you've made, or you've got some ideas for some books, but then also who are these books for? Who are these photographs for? And that there are smaller to medium to larger audiences, just as there are smaller to medium to larger projects.
And publishers.
There are also smaller, medium, and larger publishing houses. Again, tying back into this explosion in photo book publishing, there's a lot of photography book publishers out there that you may own books by that are essentially one or two people that mm-hmm. live somewhere and they make some books and they may do them in small amounts and that's it. They have low overhead. They don't own a floor of a building in Manhattan and have to deal with all of that kind of overhead. And so from the one to two person operation all the way up to places like Rizzoli and Abrams and Knopf and the bigger houses that we're all accustomed to hearing those names. Mm-hmm. To talk just about a couple of projects, just to illustrate this point about small, medium, large audiences and also projects themselves. This is a small project with a big audience. Paul Fusco was the photographer, and he was assigned, this is a historical project, he was assigned the story of riding on the train that brought Robert F. Kennedy's body from New York City down to Washington, D.C. And he rode on the train and made some slides, shot several rolls of Kodachrome. And the way this book was edited, it was just photographs of the people that had come out to honor his honor RFK as the train went by. The book only contains photographs just like this of people that were on the side of the road. It was an afternoon. It was a few hours. That project was very small and circumscribed. It didn't have. It wasn't a project that lasted 5 years and involved him traveling around the world. Just an afternoon. The audience, though, was extremely large. There was a whole body of the U.S. citizenry who loved RFK, and that story, even though it seemed like this idea of riding on the funeral train and the people who came out to honor that the train as it passed by may seem like a very sort of inconsequential or just a side note to the overall event of him having been assassinated, etc. But this book has gone into several reprintings, and it's one of those things where it's like, again, thinking about what you've photographed already or little things that may apply to larger audiences.
That you may not have even approached for exhibitions yet. It's another example, the disciples.
Exactly. So this kind of this sets up, this is at the opposite end. This is a big project with a big audience. James Mollison is a photographer, and what he did was he's been interested in what he calls typologies, looking at reoccurring things over and over in a very sort of straightforward way. So what he did is he started visiting concerts by famous musicians and photographing the people that would come to them. And he realized that if you go to one kind of a concert, people are going to arrive and look one sort of way, and if you go to another kind of concert by another artist, people are going to dress another way. And just that there's a little bit of comedy in there, but it's also a strong sociological statement about just the nature of how people like to be part of something. You go to the Jimmy Buffett concert, and that's what they're going to look like in the middle there. So again, that, and he's been able to license that work to magazines all around the world. So it had he knew that it was a bigger project that he had to invest time and energy into, but he also knew that it had a bigger audience.
Imagine the record historically. I
can see exactly.
That'll really have a long audience.
And then kind of right in the middle, Daido Moriyama is like a huge name in the history of photography in terms of the fine art world. Big name, but essentially a big name doesn't guarantee huge sales for a book. This is a book that, as most of his books do, they do not sell in large quantities. We're talking about maybe a couple thousand copies of this were printed, and maybe they're all sold. But again, if anything, it's this idea that moving away from just thinking about yourself as the artist, but also in relation to what is the subject and what is the audience that you're trying to speak to.
So hopefully that'll get you thinking about where your book might fit. And we want to give you some points that, of course, we go into much greater detail in the book. But starting with your...
Pens and paper?
Yeah.
It's all out? Are you ready?
You could really start with your own library at home and pick your three favorite photo books.
Yes.
And what is it about those books that... Why are they your favorites? What do you love about them? And some of the things you might really look hard at. Page content, of course, the number of illustrations. Is it the size of the book that you love? Is it this beast that you hold in your hands and you love that scale? Or you might love smaller books that are more private experience. What is it about these books that you love? So all those kinds of things, if it's spiral bound, if it's a perfect bound, if it's got a glossy cover, if it's just a very subtle cover that might just have varnish, like your newest book, Working the Line, is a great example of that. So it really depends on what you love. But making note... Mental note of why you love that.
I think that dissecting things is the best way to understand how to then make that thing. So again, if you close your eyes and you think to yourself, what's my favorite photography book? Go home, take that book off the shelf, and do exactly this. Count, like just sit and count the number of pages. Count how many images are in that book. You know, all of these things. If Robert Frank's The Americans is it, well, how many people can raise their hand and definitively tell me the exact trim size of that book? How many inches by how many inches?
I think we can probably remember horizontal, but that might be it.
Right, and so that sense of like, well, I love that book and I know that it's 6.5 inches square by 8.75.
Look, you
know,
you
and
go.
It's not. That, I just made that up. But but again, that sense of like, okay, really get a feel for the thing. And as Swanee said, you know, thinking about the binding and just all of these different components that make up the book.
Right.
So here's this is going to be a stack of resources that are books about photography books. And I won't give you the history of each of these, but I will say that the earliest one is on the bottom and was an amazing book that was published by a Spanish publisher, but it's in both English and Spanish, called Fotografía Pública. And that was the earliest one, and that was done in 1999.
And pretty recent, really, when we're talking about the history of photo books.
Exactly. So all in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of academic study and attention to just the history of photography books as part of the overall history of the photographic medium, which we know is only about 160 years old. So These are, as you can see by some of the subtitles, like the Book of 101 Books, which is about seminal books of the 20th century. The two in the middle are the ones that I think are the most useful. The photo book, A History, Volume 1 and 2. And there's the title, just in case you want to write that down. This two-volume set contains something like 450 books, photography books, that span the entire history of the medium up until the year the last one was published, which was 2006. And what they look like inside is kind of like this.
Really
classic
great.
Books, some obscure, obviously. This happens to be a page with two Henri Cartier-Bresson books.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it before, this is the original version of The Decisive Moment with the cover designed by Henri Matisse.
And then you
pretty
see a couple of page spreads, and there's all of the bibliographic information, like I was just asking you to figure out and write down, but like the trim size, the page count, who published it. And then at the bottom, these paragraphs at the bottom are these mini histories written by a fantastic historian. His name is Jerry Badger. And there are these little blurbs about the photographer and the book and the appearance of that book. And if you want to give yourself a graduate degree in the history of photography, just keep that by your bed and read one entry a night, and it'll take
right.
you a couple of years, and there
well,
you go, that's your graduate
wonderful.
Degree.
And you know something crazy that's happened in terms of speaking about collecting? People have now aspired to collect every book that's in these books. So it's driven that collecting market in a crazy way.
All right. So you've done all of this work.
You're sure your work is ready, right?
You're ready.
Right. You have the best work anyone's ever seen, and every publisher is going to go crazy for it.
Exactly. So now, which publisher is right for you? So now, back to this idea that there are all sorts of different publishing types of publishing companies. And I guarantee you, the editors and the publishers at publishing companies are as varied in their tastes and their approaches and their sense of history and what they want to publish as each of you are in the things you want to photograph. So this is back to doing research. And the great thing is there's lots of places that you can do good research. So I made a few sets of slides, just a couple of slides that were illustrative to me just in terms of understanding what publishers are interested in.
Well, and also a window to their brand. Because really,
exactly.
when we're speaking about which publisher is right, the homework you want to do is what is their brand? What's their mission? What's at the core of their publishing program?
Exactly. So this is a stack of books all by the publisher Trolley, which is based in the UK. And if you can see the titles, you know, the bottom one is Agent Orange, there's one on Purple Hearts, there's another one called Traces of War. You start to get the sense that this is a publisher who's interested in serious documentary projects that have to do with either contemporary events or, you know, human interaction, the effects of war. Like, and then you start to look at the even just the color palette of the books, and they all feel dark and foreboding in some ways, right? I mean, that's so there's no pretty landscape book in this stack. So when you're making that list of projects for, you know, and you're trying to figure out which publisher to approach, think about matching up what you have with what they're doing and getting a sense of what each publisher does. Now this is about as different a pile as you can get.
J&L books.
Without even knowing what's in these books, just the color palette tells you it's a completely different sensibility. This is a great small art press, J&L Books, that is that has been putting out books for like the last decade. They're all quirky, fun, kind of hipstery, but fun in a very serious way. They take playfulness seriously. And I think that their books really reflect that. And so again, thinking through some of those differences. This is another publisher, Twin Palms Publishers. The color palette is different, but also when you spend time with these, you begin to realize that they're also interested in the human condition, not necessarily the natural world, but in a different way than Trolley is. Mm-hmm. And so again, sort of thinking that through and being aware of of how each publisher approaches that.
I think it's also important for you to notice if there's a consistency in size, and that's something you know you want, a bigger book or a smaller book, but over time there's evidence that that publisher is committed to something else. Be mindful of that. That's a great clue for you to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. We're going to mention one website in relation to this aspect in particular, which is the photoeye.com website.
PHOTOEYE.
They have on their homepage in the bookstore, they have something called Publishers Showcase, which literally lists has links to all of the publishers of photography books that they deal with. You can click on each of those, and it takes you to a page within PhotoEye still, but it has covers of all of the books that that publisher has done. So it's a way to instantly kind of like get a snapshot of, well, this is what so-and-so is publishing this year, and this is what... And it's just a way to, again, to do this. This research is so easy to do now compared to, like, you know, 15 years ago. If you wanted to know what some obscure French publisher was putting out, you didn't have to call and try to get a copy of their catalog. You just go online, right? It's all so accessible.
Hopefully this will send you straight to your local bookstore with your list of what you want to see in person and touch the paper and feel the texture on the cover or not, as the case may be.
So we're going to talk just for a second about how projects arrive at the publisher. Let's say you've identified three or four publishers that you think are right for your work. So how in the world how are they going to know me? How are they going to find me?
Are you going to take their call at Radius Books? It's tough to get through it at Darius Hymes, let me tell you. So
right.
You have to think about other ways that you can get your project through.
The traditional way that many of us think about, and which is in our head, is, well, you put together a submission, and you put it in an envelope, and you send it in.
Right.
It's a blind submission, and then it ends up
looking
in a stack like
this. On Darius's desk.
On the intern's desk at the publishing house.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. Exactly. Now, that's not to say that things don't happen from blind submissions, although in surveying lots and lots and lots of publishers, many of them will just openly say, we really don't find anything in the blind submission pile. Which is why there's the next item, which actually maybe we should retitle. It's really about being part of a community. There's lots of ways that the photography community, in many ways, is unique, I think, in the art world, in that there is a lot of networking that happens within the photographic community.
We're also portable. Our work can be put in something and go to an event. So the amazing explosion of portfolio review events around the country, internationally, have allowed for many people to have their first meeting, in fact, across the table at a portfolio review event where you're having your prints, you have a discussion, the phone's not ringing. It's a fantastic way to get to know someone that you are targeting. You've done your homework, remember?
Right.
And there they are at a review event, or there they are judging a competition that you want to enter. So I always look at that as your very first way to begin a relationship. It's up to you, of course, to continue to follow up afterwards. But meeting people in our community can really be effective. And we can both come up with many examples of books that are happening today because they first met their publisher-to-be at an event like that, or they judged the work in critical mass.
Right.
I was at PhotoFest Paris 2 weeks ago. Jill and I were both there, and there was a young woman on the open portfolio night. I looked down, and I knew that I'd seen that work before, and it was from Critical Mass this fall. And in fact, she had with her layout of her book dummy. She found her publisher from that competition, Dewey Lewis, had picked the book up, and it was so exciting that can happen from your entering competition. So be targeted as much in that to meet the people in the industry.
Exactly. And so this, you know, I mean, there's an element to this where if the conversation tonight was about how to find a gallery for your work or how to find exhibition venues, many of the things we're talking about, it's the exact same principle involved. It's about finding the right connection, about being present, being out in the community. The next slide has referrals. There's several book editors in this room tonight, which I'm not going to point out because they might be swamped afterwards. But
and I know you've all got your proposal tucked under your arm, right? You're all set to go.
But this idea that the photography book publishing world, including the magazines that publish work, those who are part of portfolio review events and conferences, We all know each other, we see each other regularly, and we all talk to each other. And we're aware of the differences in our lists as publishers, in our book lists. So I may see a project, and I may say, you know what, this is not appropriate for Radius, but it may be appropriate for Princeton Architectural Press, or it might be right for Aperture, it might be right for Abrams, and vice versa. We're often sending things back and forth or making referrals to each other, and that's an important thing. So this idea of, again, being part of the community and networking within the community, it really is important.
Yeah, and following up, I will say that as a closing note on that. You really, it's up to you to keep in touch with people. So,
One other way, and I'll talk about this, we can talk about this a little bit in relation to the size of publishing companies. Many of us grew up and we hear stories about these publishing companies that find an author and they sweep them away and they give them a big fat advance check and they say, run off and do your project and we'll make you famous, and then they sell a million books and some agent was involved and got them the right deal. Pretty much that doesn't apply at all to the photography book world. So sort of set all of those expectations aside. Again, unless, I don't see Annie Leibovitz in here tonight, so you probably don't need an agent. You know, you're not, you know, that idea of having such a large project that you need somebody else to negotiate things for you is for a large portion of the projects just not applicable.
Generally speaking.
Absolutely. That's generally speaking.
I mean, there are exceptions. There are a handful of professionals in the field that act as agents that will get the work to the right place. The challenge becomes, to Darius's point, it's a scale issue. So if you've got a pie of the amount of money that you might see as a return from your book, and you slice that little pie up into lots of little pieces, it's not going to bring someone that's working as an agent very much money. So it's not to say there aren't incredibly passionate and talented agents. There are a few. We wish some of you to become agents. We'd like more of you that love books to do this. But it's not as realistic
exactly.
In the long run.
And that's, again, that's sort of being aware of the subject of your project, what your audience is. And again, there, you know, my earlier comments aside, there definitely are types of projects that do have a broad enough range, mm-hmm. that having somebody who has connections in the industry with some of those larger publishing houses does work to your advantage and is a necessary step. So again, it is part of that ebb and flow between how big is the project.
And just generally, the difference between an agent and a packager, typically an agent will take your project and place it with the right publisher. Help you with the contract, the deal is done, shake hands, they go on their way, you now have your publisher. Typically, a packager will stay on that project into publication, might be on press with you, would essentially deliver bound books to the publisher that they've placed your title with. I've seen packagers stay on the project into multiple language editions, into ancillary products, into calendars and such, and even into exhibitions, which is rare, but people that love your project might want to develop it into many different formats. But that's just a quick view of what the differences is. And in our book, we've interviewed Robert Morton, one of our favorite people that does agent books. So mm-hmm. you'll find voices from all of these Gary Chassman as packager as well. Aha, the big question.
So should you seek to be published, or should you work on going down the route of self-publishing?
Right. And in our book, we brought this up after the point of talking about your contract, because it's very often when you're offered your contract from your publisher that your preferred publisher, and they've loved the project, and here's the contract. And you may decide, you know what, I don't want to compromise. I want this particular size, or I want this particular designer, or I want this particular kind of cover that might cost more money. You may decide at that point that you want to explore self-publishing. We see people self-publishing really for two main reasons. One is to get exactly what you want in a book. And the other one is that you know exactly who the book's going to go to, and you really know your audience, and you can be very clear about it and publish just the right number at just the right price point mm-hmm. to get that book out in the way that you want. The main difference for me, however, in watching artists work as essentially producers of their own self-published book, you wear different hats. You know, not everybody is kind of a producer mindset, shall we say, mm-hmm. and can juggle many, many things. If you choose to be published, you most often have a team behind you at the publisher. Like tonight we had the benefit of the publicist at our publishing house making arrangements to have us be here. That's fantastic. We love it. Thank you so much. But are you going to be your best publicist? Or are you going to need, if you self-publish, to hire a publicist? And that's just one of the small areas within what makes a book.
Yeah. So, again, thinking about that, if you do self-publish, and again, there's a range of what that can mean, from a very sort of small, quirky thing to a larger book that is, you know, printed traditionally and that you're trying to get out into bookstores in a major way. All along there, some of the same functions still need to happen. There's still the role of the editor, somebody, you may be putting on each of these hats with self-publishing, being your own editor and really crafting what the book is about. There's the design of the book, which is also tied into essentially managing your own brand, yourself as a photographer, and this book as part of your career. And then there's the production of the physical object itself, which is about papers and printing and binding and all of that.
And typically that's something we don't generally know a lot about. You all know how to make a print on the paper of your choice, but to make a print for reproduction on a certain kind of a press is a really different beast.
Exactly. So those are all things to think about. Some other questions to ask yourself. Again, this ties back into what we've already been saying, but to remind yourself of, if you're going to self-publish, do you really know your audience? You may, and you may know exactly how to reach them, and that's something to take into consideration. Do you know how to reach them? In other words, have you established value for your work? This is one of the things that that you talk about in relation to, again, your career as a photographer. Do people know who you are and therefore know your projects, or do they just know the project and all of the relationships between how people know you and the value that you as a brand, you as something that is known in the world, is important. Mm-hmm. So a couple of other questions, which we just touched on, really, can you manage this project on your own, or should you really work with a team? And that kind of becomes the crux of it when it comes to either self-publishing or seeking out a publisher, is some of that, the amount of organization and management that you have to take on.
And we interviewed in the book people at every bit of this process, at every stage. And you'll find, for example, that Mark Klett, whom I hope all of you know Mark's work, he wrote the piece for us on bringing your work to reproduction and goes into great detail about that translation and how challenging it has been for him after many publishing projects. But mm-hmm. So those sorts of experts are people that we called upon throughout the publishing process.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're going to go into just a few self-published case studies and some of the marketing of... That's not really working, I don't think. Is it working? Yeah.
Well, it is good. Good, so I'm going to show you quickly some examples, if I may, Darius, mm-hmm. and I'll drive this. Loli Cantor is someone that I came to know at the Portfolio Review events, and she has a body of work that was about to be exhibited at PhotoFest and knew that it would have a certain number of people that would just simply happen onto it by being on the PhotoFest exhibition map, as well as her own audience of collectors and museum curators that she'd been acquainted to over the years. So she knew that she could place, she thought, 500 copies. Perfect example of self-publishing. And in 5 months, they're almost all sold out. So it was a stepping stone in her career. She hopes that that work will be something bigger in her life, but right now it's been perfect. She produced this as a Skype dialogue. Her designer was in Tel Aviv. So they worked back and forth with sending maquettes as PDFs that she would print out. I mean, it was accomplishable, without any question, on your own, and communicating with somebody remotely. It worked out beautifully. Her first slide I showed you was her website with the image of the book, and she created a self-promotion piece that had the exact same graphic identity to it. So when she went to the Portfolio Review events, she had that to match, and it's essentially branded her as a photographer. Allison Smith is someone who loves zines, or alternative to magazines, and she produces zines as her self-promo pieces. And this is her section on her website. But they are sold out in no time. They began as a way for her literally to send things out on her mailing list and be a very different kind of thing. They're small scales, you can tell from this. And she loves the idea of there being 250 of them, and then they're gone. And they truly are all gone, always. She moves on to the next projects. They're very innovative. And for Allison, she's someone whose mailing list, I think, is smart today. Her mailing list is not just gallery owners and museum curators, but it's also photo editors, great graphic designers, creatives at advertising agencies, people that can hire her. Of course, when you're your own self-publisher, you're doing all your mailing yourself. You are the collections department. You're everything. She has a blog that she talks about them on, Photo Eyes carrying them, as they do. They are one of the rare bookstores that will handle individually published things. But you can see in her store, sold out, sold out, sold out. They're all sold out. So you build a set of people waiting in anticipation for the next one at that. It's been terrific. She's used them for benefits for organizations, and she was recently hired by the Fort Worth Opera to create a zine for them for their anniversary. Pretty exciting. So it's become a great vehicle for her and something she can manage. Another example is using MagCloud, and I know some of you in the room have tried MagCloud. Jamie Stillings has produced a MagCloud piece about a new body of work, the Bridget Hoover Dam, in anticipation of having it be published traditionally again. So in these cases, they're not meant to be the end-all publication, but it's been a great way for Jamie to mail it out and get other placements. That's his website that he's made that's dedicated to the project, and amazing placements in magazines again and again. It was recently the cover of the ASMP Best Of issue, correct? And New York Times ran it on their back page of the magazine. It's really been a terrific tool for him, and that's magcloud.com. Jessica Hines used Blurb, but one of my favorite things about Jessica's piece is that she worked with a designer. So her project called My Brother's War, this is her homepage for it, and you can click into the project. She used Blurb as a way to, again, create this object and a way to know her work better, and a great thing to show publication for publication proposal to people. But I wanted to show you some of the differences in working with a designer or not. And I can tell you, I see so many, Darius, you too, we see so many books produced in print on demand that don't have a sense of design. So when we talk about what that might be, when you might wear that hat of many things, Jessica worked with Elizabeth Avedon, the designer who's actually here with us tonight, and she shared with me these slides of the kind of differences in the way that they approach things and the decisions that you have to make, right down to such simple things that when we read a book, we might not think about the fact that this had to be decided, but three different ways to begin this information and this image, and very different interpretations. Again, where a professional designer, I think, can come in to be a very important part of your decision. Simple things like this with type and chapter styles. That's the first one. Here's a different one. Subtle, but I think really important decisions. Your font. So to Darius's point earlier,
that's spelled wrong.
Really looking at, and it had a little anniversary this year too. We have to change that. But again, and here's the credit at the bottom to Elizabeth. This is Larissa LeClaire from the Indie Photo Book Project holding the book. I wanted you to be able to see the scale. This is an oversized, beautiful, beautiful volume, but a way that print-on-demand can work for you, but again, I think seek professional help in the design area. Bill Neal is someone that lives in Yosemite, produces a lot of work about the landscape, and for him, he uses the digital book as the first way that he produces the book. You can buy the books, I think, three for $25, three different titles. And what happened was he got his books out there so widely in the marketplace of, again, his audience that he knew, that they then came back to him and asked to not just buy the small version digitally, but they wanted an actual object. So he chose to then use the print-on-demand as a way to make the higher-end volume. He sort of essentially skipped the middle ground and creates the digital download and the higher end, which all come with a print. So I think it's very wise because he's growing a collecting audience at the same time. So those come in at $125. It's also been great for him to take a book that's been out of print for years and bring it back, again, only as a high end in print on demand with a print involved. So it's been terrific for him. And then one of my favorite examples of using a blog to build your audience is Phil Toledano's Days with My Father. And it's a blog that went viral, and a book did come after that. How many of you know this project? I hope all of you have seen this. If you haven't, it's dayswithmyfather.com. And it looks like this as you scroll through. It's a very poignant look at the last 3 years of his father's life and caring for him. So I went online, and I started to look at how many places had featured links to this project. It was extraordinary. Pages and pages and pages. I'm just quickly showing
these are all,
you.
Yeah, these are all different websites that did posts and did articles on the project.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So in the end, the book did get published. And here's the new home page to the website. And he actually thanks his readers because when his publisher couldn't decide which cover to use, Phil said, I've got all these emails everyone wrote me. Let's include the audience. Let's ask them. And they, in fact, chose the cover. So that was another brilliant way, I think, to include a broader audience. So Phil had worked with PQ Blackwell, Jeff Blackwell, in New Zealand, a packager that we interviewed for the book. He'd done the Photo Wisdom Project with him, and he said, what are you working on that we could collaborate on? And he said, this Days with My Father project. Well, sure enough, I mean, it came out at the time of Father's Day. It was just a perfect thing. And Chronicle was the distributor for it, and there it is on their blog, and it just it continues and continues. One of the most wonderful aspects of the project to me is that this fall, Gallery 339 in Philadelphia had an exhibition of Phil and his father's artwork together, which is a wonderful tribute, as his father had passed away, and he was an artist himself. So I'm very keen on all of you being mindful of the fine art aspects, the collectability aspect of your work. It can only help to drive the book sales all along. So this was a wonderful, wonderful thing that happened. And then I think it's really important that all of you recognize the power of multimedia, not just what we look at in terms of blogs and reading forums and such, but what can a multimedia piece do for you? And this last year, PhotoFest commissioned Brian Storm, the brilliant Brian Storm at MediaStorm, to create a multimedia piece on Snowbound. Now, mind you, this is a project that's done. It's a book that's out. So he went back and looked at a subject and a story, asked Lisa for all the work. He wanted to rethink the project. It wasn't about print anymore. It was about multimedia. So he asked to see everything, not just what made it into the book, not just the images that are collected in the marketplace, but everything, and created an amazing piece in MediaStorm. So I encourage all of you to look up Snowbound. That's what the page looks like under clients. And it will, I'm sure, have you understand the power of that. Imagine now exhibitions going forward of that body of work with the flat screen on the wall in the galleries of the museum to be able to stop and hear the artist talk about the evolution, what the work means to her. It's an extraordinary tool. So I really encourage you to have a chance to do that. And then lastly, not to remember the power of the sharing capabilities. I know a lot of you are in this room because I went to the New York Public Library website and hit the email this and blasted lots of you. I'm so glad you're here, but it was a great tool, and you should all use it in your own publications. And this is a recent title from our publisher, from Princeton Architectural Press. And when you click on the share button, you'll see this is a small selection, but plenty for most of us, of ways to spread the word about that publication. So utilize those kinds of things without any question. In terms of marketing your book, I want to dive right into a couple of examples. I encourage all of you to have a website in the name of your title. Because remember, where Darius was saying, you know, they don't necessarily know you yet, but they may love your subject. People might remember the name of your exhibition that they saw listed, but not you. So this is Michael Rauner's homepage. Michael Rauner.
For him as a photographer.
That's right. And the book on the left, you can click on the book, and we're still on his website, learning more about the book. But if you click on the website for the book, it takes us to a different place, takes us to a different URL, and matches that graphic identity of the book project itself. So that's something you should definitely be mindful of from the get-go. Another project is Mary Luddington's Nature of Dogs. This is her homepage. This is her book cover. The graphic identity carries all the way through. Arthur Drucker, with his project American Ruins, you'll see that his webpage now has traveling exhibitions. So I hope that you'll all think long-term and have that as well as something that will continue to get the book out there but also build your value as a collectible artist. This is his exhibition packet, and you can see that he's taken the cover image and branded it all the way through to the CD that goes with the exhibition packet. This is Lauren Henkin's website. Her emails that come, and this is what her website looks like. And I'll show you that again. I think the graphic consistency is crucial. I rarely get emails that look as thorough as this, and then the website's beautiful. So a recent announcement that she had in email was of a limited edition artist book that she had. Again, follow the graphic continuity. And this is her promo piece that she gives out at the portfolio review events. The palette, the style, the font, everything carries through. White Gallery recently sent this out, and again, this is email. He's embedded a video talking about his book project. And donating money to that book project, 100% goes back to the victims of the Haiti earthquake. And the website at the same time needs to match that. So the continuity was crucial. Lee Friedlander, I hope all of you have seen this exhibition at the Whitney. And there's two versions of this book. There's a small scale, then there's the $350 larger book that this is. And on the Whitney's homepage, they link you to the distributor who links you through to YouTube. And this is what happens on YouTube. I think this is the smartest, cheapest marketing you can do. This is an 8-minute piece, no audio. I'm just going to show you a tiny bit of it. But it's showing every single page of the book. Really smart. So you get the experience of it without much of an investment. And one of the things that's crucial to all of us is that you understand that you need to be a partner to your publisher. You've got to help your publisher. It's the smartest thing that you can do. This is Traer Scott with Joan Brookbank at Merrill at the big Book Expo America at the Javits in May, at the time that her books came out, dutifully signing copies for the industry professionals that are coming. And it's really just something that's important to do. I also remind all of you to document the process of making your book. One of my favorites is this beautiful piece that Lumiere Press did on Paul Caponegro recently. And again, go look at Lumiere Press. This is a wonderful thing they did, documenting the entire process from the original letters from Paul to the publisher saying, yes, let's do it. This is the mailing label of the prints that arrived at the publisher. The map on Thomaston, Maine, where they had coffee and the business card of the place. The audio cassettes of the recordings for the interviews. Every step of it is crucial. And then I think one of the most exciting things to do in terms of thinking about your book to be overall is to attend as many book fairs as you can. And how many of you got to the New York Art Book Fair about a month ago? Oh, next year, you have to all go. It's free. It's the most amazing thing. It's co-sponsored by Printed Matter. And it was at PS1 this year, and I'll just show you a little bit of what things looked like. I just find it so inspiring. And one of my absolute favorite booths was Silas Finch's booth. This is Kevin Messina showing the work of Debbie Luster and a project that Raymond Meeks, the great book artist Raymond Meeks, has produced in their new line, Orchard Journal. And Ray was at the booth for the whole weekend talking about the project and the decisions they made in publishing choices. That's Kevin and Ray on the right, and the website for it. This book comes out in 3 price points. We talked about the Friedlander having 2. This one has 3 different price points, the 45, the 125, and the 550. So 1 print, 3 prints, or all 9 prints from the series. So it's another way to reach a very important collectible audience, not diffusing your potential to reach
I want to throw something in there. Go on the last slide. Okay. Often there's this worry. Photographers will ask, well, if I make a video and show my entire book online, aren't I giving away the content for free? Well, yeah, of course you are, which is great because you want people to see that, because the whole point with a photo book is that eventually people want to own the actual thing. It's not like somebody's going to take a video and somehow mount it on their wall. Right? I mean, it's about teasing people. It's about giving them access to information. And it's the same thing. Yes, of course, your images exist online and people can see them there, but how many of us have actually like printed off a little 72 JPEG online and then hung it on our wall? None of us, right? So, well, maybe a few of us, I'm not sure. But but this idea of, you know, if I guarantee you, like if I saw a video of this book, it would probably just push me that much further into committing to one of these 3, you know, and you never know, there's the impulse buy of the, you know, I'm going to get that really expensive one because I love it so much. And so just all of these technologies just can help sort of, again, create more interest in your project.
Absolutely, without any question. So just a few more pictures of what the fair looked like. And this was Andrew Roth's booth. They had a 10-year anniversary, and here's the treasured. If any of you own this book, take very good care of it, the Book of 100 Books. So it's very exciting, and it kind of just breaks down all the barriers to what's expected and what's not. JNL, of course, was there. This, what I thought was very fun, as a way to display the books. They just brought their suitcases in and set it up, and that was the show. A lot of zines hanging on the wall. Fantastic. And this is the Little Brown Mushroom booth, Alex Soth on the left, with signing and selling his latest. And this was the woman I mentioned earlier who, at the Photo Fest Paris, that was her book Dummy that had happened from submitting to Critical Mass, which was fantastic. This was at Perry Photo. This was the Fiden booth, and I found it fascinating that they showed the limited editions, and then you can see on the wall, they have the objects matted, framed, presented beautifully. And this is, I thought I'd capture some of the copy to share with you. They, of course, had it in English and French. And signed, in the language of collectible artifacts, signed and stamped by the photographer on the reverse, packaged together with the signed and numbered custom-bound special edition of the book. It's treated in a special, special way, and given the wall space. There were so many publishers at the fair. It was really exciting. And then across the river, there was this, at the Mint, the old Mint, the Musée de la Monnaie, was an exhibition about the making of a book with Gerhard Steidl. I mean, now we have publishers for whom entire exhibitions are built around. And the opening of the show looked like this. And when you came in from outside, there was a stack of posters on a pallet, just like book pages arrive. And inside the entry where there was the CMYK stacks, which you could take one of each of those. And the last one showed the CMYK coming together to make colors as we know them. And this was the first room in the show before they made me stop taking pictures. So this is all I could capture for you. But this is the Americans room. These are all different versions of the Americans. Photographs
Robert Franks,
on the wall.
Right.
Yeah, Robert Franks Americans. Correspondence between Robert and Grove Press when that book first came out, that version. Very, very interesting. They did the same with Louis Baltz's recent book, Jim Dine. Just incredible. Again, the making of is important, but for us to learn about a publisher in that way was fascinating. So that's a kind of a tour
yeah,
there.
And just to wrap that up a little bit, I mean, if you can all sort of like hear the paradox in this, which is that the internet has essentially helped fuel this renaissance in printed reproduction techniques. I mean, there's an exhibition showing you how CMYK works, not showing you how pixels appear on your digital screen. So this whole idea that there really is this exciting sort of not even underground movement, but just this excitement around photography books.
Right.
So a couple of the final things that we share.
Yeah.
In the book are some timelines. There's a timeline, this is back in the resource section, you're not going to be able to really see that completely, but there's a timeline on the making of your book,
right.
Starting from, you know, when the book arrives and stepping backwards to how far back do you need to be to think about submitting to a publisher and how long
exactly.
It takes.
Yeah, all the different steps, and we really thought that would be something incredibly helpful for all of you to envision before starting that process on your own, not just for production and design, but we did another one on marketing.
So the next timeline is there's a timeline for marketing that goes from the book. The book launch is actually, I think, the second to the last on the right there, and then beyond. So
because
leading up to the launch and then beyond, exactly.
Yeah. So things
so helping
to be
you
mindful
think,
of.
Totally. There's some upcoming seminars. We're just going to mention this quick. There's one in Phoenix in January, and then all next year there's going to be a few seminars that we're going to do.
So when you're freezing in January,
right, exactly.
Come spend a weekend with us and go into this in much greater detail. Or in Santa Fe, Darius and I every year teach one-week class where the 14 students that work with us, we go into great detail with their projects, but also we get to visit places like Radius Books, Twin Palms, Photo Eye Bookstore. There's a tremendous number of people in Santa Fe that have successfully self-published. We talk about that process of the publishing cycle, and very helpful to everybody. So
the website for this book is publishyourphotographybook.com. You can join our mailing list there and get all sorts of updates. And We're going to do some questions and answers now. So thank you all for your attention. And
So I hope that was helpful. We have a question already.
Can we stand here? Is that okay? Do you want us to be in the chairs?
Okay.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Sitting, okay.
This is the first. We'll be sitting. So, question, sir.
Yes. I'm asking as an amateur, so this is not career-oriented. And I may be the only amateur in the room, but I suspect not. My project goes back several years, and all the images are in slides. Do you have any advice about reverting to digital?
Boy, edit some more before you go into that process. It's so cumbersome.
And I'm assuming they're 35 millimeter slides?
Yes.
Right. There's ways to scan transparencies at high resolution,
yes.
And so that's not a complete worry. In fact, Aperture just did a book of William Christenberry's work from the last four decades, most of which were from his Kodachromes. So you could take a look at that and just sort of see what that feels like, but it's possible. And there are scanning houses in the city that will help you with that.
I just have to say, I see a lot of photographers struggling with that because many of us are old enough that we love our Kodachrome and our Agfa color and such. But I don't want you to spend so much time doing that that you don't get the project done. So that might be a place where you'd have someone help you edit to move it along faster because you want it to happen.
So the difference between editing and sequencing, right? When we say edit the work, we're talking about deciding what goes into the book, right? And again, when you go home and you take your three favorite books and you count how many pages and you count how many illustrations, you'll start to get a sense of how many images are in the photography books that you like. There may be 40, there may be 60. So you don't have to take your 500 slides and get them all drum scanned and then edit that down to 50. Do the editing part of it first so that then you're, right? So that's...
Save the
other questions, sir?
What have you seen in the comparison between the United States, Asia, and Europe in terms of printing self-printing?
Printing, right.
Quality as well as price.
Mm-hmm. Right. Unfortunately, the printers in the United States, as good as they are also the most expensive right now in the world. So that's where you hear a lot of people will go to printing plants in China or Italy or Europe.
Iceland.
There are printers everywhere. Like there are printers here in New York City, there are printers scattered throughout the country. And sometimes, depending on the type of project, you can get a quote, a bid from a printer that is reasonable. It just depends on the type of project. And with printers, they all have their specialties as well. So some printers are more specialized with working with color photographs than others. You know, many may print advertising for a living and aren't familiar with printing fine art books. So again, being aware of those things. But the differences are negligible on the one hand. There are many printers in Asia and also in Europe that are they're peers to each other. They do beautiful work. The experience can be different. Just as a tourist trip to Italy is going to be different than a tourist trip to China. And so just being, you know, there are things like that. So going on press in different places is part of that. Right now, Asia, meaning China and Korea, have the most competitive pricing in the world, which is not to say that they're the cheapest and also then the connotation with that they somehow don't do good work. Those two things also don't equate.
In a practical aspect, however, you've got to add the cost. If you're going to be on press, that's going to be a plane ticket that's going to bring your prices up. And shipping, exactly. Not just the cost of shipping, but I want to add to that the time required for shipping. If you've got an exhibition and it has to be there on a certain date, be careful about adding any risk to the delivery of that.
Right.
Like, many people forget that the shipping container industry in the months before Christmas is kind of busy all over the world. So you don't want to get caught in that and have your project come out in February instead of December. So
yeah,
be thoughtful
yeah.
about that. Great question. Thank you.
Right here.
How do you protect ideas when you present to a book? I present
copied a year later by the publisher with another photographer. Are there such a thing as non-disclosure agreements?
That's a good question.
The other part is, what are the splits between a publisher and, like, the photographer?
The question is, it sounds like the gentleman presented a concept for a book to a publisher who rejected that concept, but then a year later did that concept with another photographer. Is that a summary? I don't know what the protections are in that sense. That's a bummer.
But you could certainly draft a non-disclosure for any kind of meeting in your professional life. If you chose, they have the option to sign it or not. Always good to register your images with the Copyright Office. Remember that when you publish things on your website, it is considered published, so register them in the right category. Neither of us are lawyers, so we should have that disclosure here.
Non-lawyer.
well,
it's not, I mean, it also depends on, again, this ties back into the type of publisher and the size of the publishing house.
And the relationship.
And the relationship. You know, this is also to talk about how some books come across. What you just touched on is the fact that there are projects that come by a photographer bringing either an existing body of work to a publishing house and saying, do you want to do these images? Or by bringing a concept. Like let's take the Andrew Zuckerman book, for instance. Maybe the next one he wants to do is dogs, and he's already pitched that idea and said, the next book I want to do is going to be dogs, and it's going to be shot in the same way. That's a concept that's being offered, right? It goes the other direction as well. At some of the larger publishing houses, the editors themselves are extremely creative and know their market and will go out and commission projects. Like, for instance, there was a book recently, I think it was the 100th anniversary of Central Park, like maybe 2 years ago, something like that. And I was talking with an editor who, about 4 years ago, and they were discussing the names of photographers that would be appropriate to do a book. Like, they wanted to do that book, and they were looking to commission it. So this idea that books get generated in all sorts of different ways. So it also, in terms of you, then the second question was about splits and
right.
royalties. All of that is completely negotiable. Larger projects that have broader audiences, there's more money involved. Most of the many smaller projects, meaning a lot of the art books that we're familiar with that are from smaller publishing companies, are 3,000 copies or less. That's actually a sort of, in all of our surveys with publishers, a lot of the photography books that we know are published in 3,000 to 5,000 title quantities, and there's there's less money involved, and so all of that becomes something that's negotiable.
Percentages on it that are average?
Not really.
Not anymore.
No.
Things have really changed, and I find that a lot of artists that are looking to have a particular kind of book in a certain number might, in fact, prefer, rather than getting a check in a year for royalty, they'd rather have books now. So many people are choosing to take their royalty in the form of books to use as a tool to move their career forward. So every situation is unique.
Yeah. In the back here? And then
Elizabeth?
Behind,
someone?
Yes, you. Sir.
Going back to the idea of self-publishing and choosing a printer, whether it's here or abroad, how do you navigate your way through all that, learning about different options? Are there brokers or agents or people that aggregate the information that you can go to?
There are indeed. There are print brokers that work with printing plants overseas. There will be some printing plants that have offices in either New York or on the West Coast, and they work directly with that plant. Or there may be print brokers who work with a series of different plants around the world that they've established these relationships with. Mm-hmm. So you can look for printing brokers, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And some of the websites for printing brokers will have a vocabulary, essentially, for you, a checklist. of things to think about when you go to them, you know, the language that you may not be familiar with, of whether it's as simple as coded and uncoded, or the type of binding and the type of treatment for the cover and fabric or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the things that you might not think of when you're looking at home doing your homework on your three favorite books.
Exactly.
They can help you to learn that. The web is great in that way.
There's a fair that happens every year here in New York called Book Expo America, which has traditionally been an industry event that's for booksellers around the country to come and see publishers from all over the world and see what the new titles are coming up. But there are often a lot of print brokers and printing companies that also have booths there. And as just a member of the public, you can buy a ticket and go to the fair for 2 or 3 days and you can learn a lot.
It's fantastic. And it's bookexpoamerica.com. And it's held just prior to Memorial Day, like the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They have a super educational component downstairs in the exact place that we all go at Photo Plus, that same hall at the Javits that we live in for 3 days. It becomes the education component there. And they also do quite a few webinars. There's one coming up on Tuesday, in fact, that
right.
Book Expo is doing on using social media, social networking, to broaden the audience for your book. So it's a good place to learn. BookExpoAmerica.com, BEA.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be in New York for the next few years, and then they take it back on the road to different
cities. It used to travel to a different city every year, but it's been in New York for a while.
Yeah, and I have to say, many of you may have gone to the APAD Fair, for example, or other art gallery expos, and you know how you go in and every art dealer has their booth, and we learn a lot about their brand by standing there, not just looking at pricing and edition numbers, but overhearing the dialogue. It's the same way at Book Expo America, because there will be Simon & Schuster, Random House, etc. All the brands will be there. And you can get a sense, stand back, look at the kind of get a sense of the corporate culture of that company, as well as the forthcoming titles.
Mm-hmm. In the back here?
First,
before. Can you cover the financial aspects of working with publishers?
We do to a certain extent, yes. Again, to repeat what I said earlier, there's no formula. So we don't go into specifics in the sense of, like, for instance, this is exactly the type of royalty you can expect or anything like that. But the broader principles regarding illustrated books are as follows when it comes to finances. Small audiences mean that you generally have need to fundraise around the project. Larger projects that are often subject-driven that have 10, 20, 50,000 copy things, you can actually negotiate for an advance. That's into a whole realm that can start to get really tricky, all depending on how you think about it and how you talk about it. The way I like to think about it is that traditionally the arts have had patrons. It used to be the church and the crown. The church and the crown are no longer major patrons of the arts, at least not in this country.
They're broke, I think.
They're broke.
Yeah.
But that need for patronage in relation to the arts, I mean, there are so many major institutions across this country that are devoted to the arts that require patronage. They require foundations. They require individual contributions. There's the reality of publishing a book that's 3,000 copies or less, just selling the trade edition of that copy, you lose money. So it starts to sound like a crazy business to be in. The reason you're in it is because you love the arts and you want to contribute and be part of advancing civilization through this medium. So then that becomes a way. So it requires then getting at dealing with those financial realities. So in this country, there are state level organizations that support the arts, that offer grants for projects, that offer publishing grants. In Europe, it's the same thing. If you look at books, there's often 4 or 5 logos of different supporting organizations. So it really becomes just part of the landscape of building a career in the arts.
And I'd like to add to that when you're asked to contribute, it may be that it takes a different form than cash. So, for example, if you're thinking about who the audience is for your book and you identify a group that, in fact, you can find, or they have a membership association, or they have an annual conference, is there some way that you can get your book project in front of them and offer them a pre-publication special deal? If you can then go to the publisher and say, here's my project, and by the way, I've pre-sold 10,000 copies to the Association of American whatever, and they get their book that maybe the CEO can write a special thing in the first page, or they can get a slipcase copy, and 500 of those can have a special print with it. You know, some, create some kind of opportunity for someone that's within the logical audience for your book. A publisher would be very happy to hear that. Am I correct? That's, as a publisher, you'd say that that might
no,
work?
That's good. Yeah, that might work.
Yeah, might help.
It also, again, this ties into how you think of your overall career in photography. So if your goal ultimately, one of the goals is to sell your work in a fine art context, then a book, it, on a certain level, is a promotional device to promote your work as a fine art photographer, and the prints sell for this much, and here's an exhibition that's coming up, and you've been part of that. And so in the end, whether people buy a $35 book of your work or whether they buy a $1,500 print, well, which one would you rather they buy? The book may actually help you sell 20, you know, may help you sell prints that end up becoming, that advance your career in a way where the actual, any sort of profit from a book is negligible in
right.
that larger context.
So that's a longer term strategy. And I see some people looking at their marketing budget and putting themselves at the portfolio review events that they know the publishers that they want to speak to are going to be at. So that investment is wise. I want to share with you one of my favorite examples of that exact thing about strategizing. Mona Kuhn, I hope you all know Mona's work. Mona decided that rather than going on the road and going to all the portfolio review events, she wanted to have a beautiful object that put her work in print that she could mail to people. So instead of physically going, she decided to invest in an object instead. So she produced a small book. This was her early work that was in black and white, and it had 14 images in it. There were some pages of text. There was a one-page summary of her career.
It was like
career.
32 pages total.
It's a tiny, beautiful little thing. $3 a piece. She had bought 3,000 of them, so they were $3 a piece in the end. And as she said, they lived as furniture in her house for a while because there were a lot of them. But bit by bit, as her, she knew that she wanted to have, a, her goal was to have a book with Gerhard Steidel. And she knew that when she put that packet together to go to Gerhard Steidel of her next body of work, that when she slipped that little publication in, it would tell the publisher she had experience working in print. She had been through that whole process, and that it would make a strong impression. And in fact, it did. And he's published, I think, 3 books of her work now. But she still says that book was the greatest investment for her, to have a smaller thing. And this is something, by the way, we were, a colleague of mine and I were talking with print broker recently, and a lot of the print brokers will help you to produce something that's beautiful and small and targeted, like an exhibition catalog or a promo piece. So you'll all decide where you want to spend your money and who you want to reach and what the path is the best.
That's a good point. Like, you don't have to do your first book and fly to Shenzhen, China to have it printed.
Yeah.
You can do something small that's 16 pages, that's 24 pages, that's a small showcase of your work. That is something that is, essentially, it's an investment. It's a marketing investment in your career. And thinking of books that way is important.
One of my favorite little self-promo pieces that that I carry around with me right now is one of the 7x7 little small blurb pieces. And one of the reasons it works so well for me is it's kind of a catalog of that person's work, but it doesn't memorialize a specific exhibition. In other words, it's not dated. It doesn't expire. But it's beautifully designed. The photographer worked with a designer. And it just transcends those that don't.
Ma'am.
I've had some experience with self-publishing. And I've come to the conclusion that if you want to self-publish or if you want a publisher to publish your book, it's good to be independently wealthy.
It never hurts to be independently wealthy, I'd say.
Yeah, that's a statement for kind of any industry. Exactly.
True. All want thousands of books to
yeah.
distribute.
It's true. That is a challenge. That's part of why we hope that you've built great mailing lists along the way and that you're entrepreneurial in spirit to get the work that are published out to more people as well. There is a number of small distributing companies that do distribute independent projects. The one that comes to mind is Consortium. And they always have a booth at Photo, at the Book Expo. You could go and see the kinds of things they take on. And then, of course, Photo Eye in Santa Fe is one of our great places that will take it on. You'll find that many local museums will take on a regional project when they can do business with you, essentially, and you can come in with your book. Have you found that to be the case? When you were at Photo Eye, that was...
Yeah. One of the difficulties with small independent bookstores is the overwhelming amount of paperwork that comes with selling books. It's easier to deal with one publisher where you get many titles from them rather than dealing with every single person in here as their own publisher.
Right.
So that's just one of the hurdles. But again, I want to say that this idea, again, of thinking through how this book is serving your career and ultimately what you want. So, you know, I'm assuming everybody in here has essentially chosen the arts as their career path. And if you haven't figured this out already, you must know that being in the arts is about cobbling together a career, right? It's not like there's entry points and then we work our way up in a very straightforward way. So it's about doing lots of different things. It's about trying to being parts of group shows and entering contests and doing assignment work that may not be your most favorite thing for a while. And so there's all of these different things. So again, seeing how the book can be something that not expecting the book to become the paycheck, but rather that the book becomes the thing that helps you cobble together ever bigger projects that then continue to lead your career forward. Does that sound fair? Does that make sense?
We see that happen all the time, where a beautifully produced book will really jump them forward in their career.
How many people in here have art degrees? Okay, quite a few. And the rest of you? I'm just kidding.
Business degrees.
Right.
Their books are going to get out there.
Yeah, what's the joke? The joke is that when people in the business world get together, they talk about the arts, and when people in the arts get together, we all talk about business. We try to figure out how to, right?
That's so, great. I think Elizabeth had a question on the
Yes. Arts. No. Are there any other questions? One more question. Yeah, that's a good question. The question is there an amount of time from you've got the project and then to seeing it on the bookshelves, let's say that, from beginning to end of it? I think a safe bet is to say between a year and a year and a half to give it that amount of time, meaning the work has all been made and you've pitched it to a publisher, to the time that it goes on press and you get copies, about a year to a year and a half.
If you self-publish it, I hope
4 to 5 years.
Yeah.
No, I'm just
kidding. Thank you.
I hope that you'll give it as much attention
as
a publishing team would for you at a publisher. And it's essential. One of my favorite case studies in the book, Lisa Robinson talks about knowing that her work, as she was making it, she really wanted to have a book in the end. Exhibitions as well, but she loved books. And so she used print on demand as the body of work grew to know the work better, to begin to think about sequencing and editing the work. And that process, when she came to the publisher, went much faster. Did not take a year and a half. She sped right through design because she was ready for it. The exhibitions were in place. They had a goal for those books when they got done. So I would think about all of those steps before you knock on the door and have as much in place as you can.
Thank you all so much. Arezu.
Thank you so much for this informative and inspiring presentation. I just want everyone here to know that we were planning on having copies of the book for you available for purchase here tonight. So tell us when they can go out and buy the book.
What's the corporate line? We have our publishers here, but
The book will be available in February.
Yeah.
If you want to take a postcard, there's all of the information about it, and of course you can join our mailing list on the website.
And we'll be happy to tell you when it's coming.
But Princeton Architectural Press is publishing the work, and we're looking forward to all of you getting a copy.
So I hope it was helpful. Did you all enjoy it?